You're listening to the Rockford Symphony Orchestra podcast, where we look to inform about our upcoming events and give insight to behind-the-scenes happenings at the RSO. In this episode, we dove into guest conductor Kevin Stites' connection to the RSO, as well as the programming for the upcoming Americana performance. Hear the story behind the pieces, the influences of the composers, and how we will highlight the American experience in a way that everyone can relate to.
This is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra guest conductor Kevin Stites. We are discussing the RSO's presentation of Americana on Saturday, April 29th, 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. I'm going to say welcome back. You have called the RSO your hometown orchestra. Why do you call it that?
Well, I grew up right down the road, right down Route 20 in Pecatonica, Illinois. Raised there. My parents lived there until they passed away a few years ago. I went to U of I in Champaign-Urbana. I moved back here during COVID, 2020, after 25 years in New York. So Pecatonica, it, for all intents and purposes, is my home. However, the Rockford Symphony is something that I grew up with. And also going to the Coronado back when it was a movie theater was quite quite a part of growing up in this area. So it absolutely feels like my hometown orchestra.
Oh, terrific. That sounds like a good reason to me. So you have been quite busy over the years. I mean, Chicago, Hollywood, Broadway, I could go on and on, all bunch of places. Could you give an idea of some of the things you've been doing?
Well, last summer, I had a bucket list item come true. I was able to conduct the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at Ravinia for a celebration of Stephen Sondheim. I've done a lot of guest conducting across the nation, notably with the Los Angeles Philharmonic at the Hollywood Bowl and Walt Disney Concert Hall, also the Grant Park Symphony in Millennium Park. And as I said, I lived in New York for 25 years, and there I was fortunate enough to have worked on 13 Broadway shows, and spent six seasons at Radio City Music Hall as music director for the Christmas Spectacular, and did a number of national tours, and have been fortunate enough to work in concert with some pretty terrific artists, including Kristen Chenoweth, who appeared with the RSO, and I was able to conduct that concert. So that was pretty terrific. But so I've been around for a little bit.
Yeah, well, sounds great. Well, let's get to the program on April 29th. Why did you call it Americana?
It's interesting. It's inspired by America, the American experience, the American culture, its people, and the very land itself. It's not all music by Americans, but it is definitely music about America. Not the America of flag waving and an ultra patriotism of George M. Cohan or any of that. It's really what I consider to be the heart and soul of America, its people, its indigenous people, and equally as importantly, the land, the expanse and the variance that this country has from, I hate to say, sea to shining sea.
Right.
You know, the topography is unbelievable. And the three pieces I've chosen sort of pull from each of the elements I just spoke about.
Well, speaking of the pieces,
yes.
Let's talk about the first one.
Okay.
Discover the Wild Overture by Kenneth Fuchs. And, you know, I'm not real familiar with him. So why don't you tell us something about Fuchs?
Well, Ken Fuchs is a Grammy-winning contemporary American composer, currently on the Faculty of Composition at the University of Connecticut. He writes tonal orchestral music, I think with great imagination, advanced but incredibly accessible writing. We're not talking 12-tone rows or anything like that. It's fresh. I believe it has a uniquely American sound, which is most evident in the piece I selected for this concert, and recorded quite often in London at a little place called the Abbey Road Studios, which we may know. And there's a very wonderful woman conductor named Joanne Folletta, that is a champion of his works. And he has, I believe, 5 recordings, I would say albums in the old days, of material. He guests artists in residence all over the country. He's also written pieces for voice. I did a mono opera of his, one-man opera with orchestra about, it's called Falling Man, and it's based on the 9/11 experience. And that's all I'll really say about it. But that's where I met him, and it was performed at the 9/11 Museum, which was really pretty spectacular. Now, the orchestra has not done a piece by Kenneth Fuchs before, so I'm happy to introduce his music to this orchestra and hope that they will repeat the experience.
How did the Discover the Wild Overture come about? I mean, why was it written?
You know, the last concert I was fortunate enough to do here was the John Williams concert back in February, music for film. Well, Ken was approached to write theme music for a documentary called Discover the Wild, about the land and topography of Wyoming, that region, that great West area. And it was to be a nature documentary TV series. He composed 2 themes and then combined them into one cohesive piece. It's a 3-part piece, with the first theme, which is based on intervals of the fourth. The second theme is a more, I don't want to say romantic, but placid and lovely, lovely theme based on the intervals of the fifth, and then a recapitulation with the same motive based on the fourths. It very much has Copland-esque overtones, and you can sort of see the majesty, I believe, of Wyoming and all of that. Unfortunately, the series was not picked up. It never came to fruition. He wrote the piece and never got paid.
Oh, boy.
So, and it was written in 2007. So he turned it into a concert overture. And a good composer will never throw a tune away.
No.
But he thought this was going to be his John Williams moment. Mm-hmm. And I think when the audience hears the piece, you know, you can clearly hear it's like program music. You can sort of see through hearing what he intends. It's a really good opening for this concert.
That's great. So let's go on to the next part of the program, which is Symphony No. 1 in E minor by Florence Price. She was more than a composer, I believe, was she not?
Well, she was, yes, a composer, came from a very, very good family, born in Little Rock, Arkansas. But she was a music teacher, an organist, and a pianist, as well as a composer. She served on the faculty of the New England School of Music, which I spend a lot of time in Boston, and there's a hall called Jordan Hall, which has a magnificent organ in it, and that's where she used to play. And I've seen several concerts in there. It's spectacular. But so she was very, very well-rounded, but first and foremost a composer.
And she's known to be the first Black woman to have her works performed, I believe, by a major symphony orchestra. Is that not correct?
That is correct, and it's a really pretty terrific story. There was a competition. The Wanamaker Foundation had a competition, and it was for music by Black American composers. She entered the competition. She entered 2 pieces. 3 prizes were to be given at the end of that evening, and she entered a symphony, and it's just now escaped me what the other piece was. But of the 3 prizes, she was awarded 2 of the 3, and each of them was a cashed-out figure of $250. So she walked away with $500. More importantly, with the promise that her work would be premiered by a major symphony orchestra.
And what orchestra was that?
Well, it's a little orchestra down the road called the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, which is pretty terrific. And its conductor, Frederick Stock, was very impressed and scheduled it to be on a very important concert of Black composers at the Auditorium Theater, again, down the road. The night before, it seems so inappropriate to even say it today, but there was to be Black Day at the Chicago World's Fair. But it was 1933, I'm sorry. And this concert was to sort of kick that off. Appropriate or not, it was well intended. It was notable that in the audience was one Mr. George Gershwin, who was a fan of her work. And it was so popular, the thought was that she might actually break through as number one, a woman composer, and number two, a black woman composer. That's sort of a double header there. Unfortunately, didn't quite happen for her because I believe of the two things I just mentioned. So now is the time where her stuff is starting to emerge in great detail, or a great amount of material is coming out, being recorded by really great artists, and it's getting the recognition that it should. It's just taken all these years to do it, nearly 100 years to do it.
And it has been described as always original and stands on its own. So how so?
Well, she drew upon what she knew, and that would be the music of the African-American experience. And a lot of people don't like the African-American moniker anymore, but it is absolutely applicable for this. Her music is soulful. It's plaintive. You can hear a little pain in it. You know, we're not in 1932, 33. We're not really that far from slavery when you stop and think about it.
Right.
It's closer than you think. If you take 60 years away from where we are now, that seems like yesterday. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't that long before that. So you can hear a lot of pain, burden, I call it. There are slave-like melodies in the music. The third movement in particular is based on an African dance called the Jubal Dance, J-U-B-A-L, and it uses a steady drum beat on African drums of two different sizes that is an upbeat tempo with a very infectious ragtime-like syncopated melody above it. It's very much almost a cakewalk feel at one point in it, and it's sort of like what you would have heard, I imagine, on the levee, you know, on the Mississippi River with the stevedores, music that they would have sung and or played, and it permeates that piece. But the third movement especially is completely of a sound that's not like the other part of the symphony. It's completely devoted to a typical African dance. The piece is so dense and so well written, and the themes come back like any good symphony does throughout the movements. There are four movements. It has been, there is conjecture that says that Florence Price was greatly influenced by the New World Symphony by Anton Dvorak, which so happens to be the remaining piece on the program. There are so many parallels, especially in the first movement. The key area, first of all, Dvorak is in E minor, the Florence Price is in E minor, but the structure of the first movement, the inspiration of the melodies, which we'll probably talk about in a second, where Dvorak got his inspiration, and just in feel, it's very clear to me, at least, that she was heavily influenced by Dvorak, which was 1893, what, 40, 50 years before? Not so long.
No.
You know, it wasn't like it was ancient music to her. It was still fresh. To us, it seems like, you know, a museum piece.
Well, you mentioned Dvorak, so let's move there. Now, he was born in the Czech Republic. So why is Dvorak in a program called Americana?
Yeah, perfect question. The most perfect question ever. Well, Dvorak himself gave the work the subtitle Aus der Neuen Welt, from the New World. The New World he is referencing is America. The piece was written in America, in Ohio, and inspired by the sights and sounds he experienced in America of 1893. You know, it should be noted that he spent a great deal of time in America. He was Czech-born, and his rise to fame was very slow, very much like Florence Price. Mm-hmm. And he won a contest as well. Florence Price won the Wanamaker contest. Anton Dvorak won a contest, who's one of the judges on the jury was Johannes Brahms, who took a fancy to Dvorak's music. He wrote letters of instruction to various publishers for Dvorak. This led to an offer of employment from the National Conservatory of Music in New York City, which no longer exists. It paid very, very well. So he accepted the job, and he was head of the school from 1892 to 1895. He composed the New World Symphony, which is his ninth symphony, between January and May of 1893. It debuted in December of 1893 in Carnegie Hall, and it garnered rapturous critical and popular reception. People went crazy for it. In the days leading up to the concert, excerpts of melodies from the symphony were published in the paper. So there was a little bit of like sneak preview. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do like little audio clips back in those days,
no.
But they would, you know, you could see a little bit of the thematic work. And so there was already a lot of good sort of feeling about it. And it is reported that the reaction was critically and popularly huge at its debut performance. And interestingly enough, every single separate movement was cheered. And Dvorak happily stood and acknowledged the applause between movements, which is a topic that I've been researching, because I've always wondered where this tradition of not clapping between movements came from. And it turns out, you know, there are several composers that never would have thought, why not clap? Or they would have thought, why not clap? You know, Schumann did not like it. I can't remember the other one, but several people thought, why not? And one of the accounts I read, theory was that it became sort of an elitist thing amongst the wealthy concert goers. I'm of the opinion that the audience should applaud when they are moved to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And I just find that concerts shouldn't be so stuffy that if after the first movement of a symphony, it's fantastic and builds to such a fevered pitch that there is nothing wrong with the audience letting that go and giving it some applause. I will not mind if that happens. There was recently, I heard a recording of a live broadcast of Yaniv Sagan, the new conductor at the Met, conducting the Florence Price Symphony, First Symphony, in Berlin, and the Berlin audience, rapturous applause between movements. I didn't mean to get off on that tangent, but I found it interesting that there are accounts of that Dvorak was so thrilled with the response his piece got that he actually stood up in Carnegie Hall and acknowledged that applause.
Well, you mentioned that his rise to popularity and fame was slow. Why so with him?
I actually am not sure, because I find the early music really great. I don't know enough to be able to say that there's one reason. With Florence Price, she had an obvious handicap, being a woman and being black. Dvorak, I honestly just don't know enough. It was sort of the thing of being able to get the music to the right people who would publish it and take interest in it. And by Brahms writing letters to various publishers, well, who's not going to listen to Johannes Brahms?
Right.
That's all it took, was people being able to hear it. Again, this weren't the days where you could just tune into Sirius XM, the Symphony Hall channel, and hear various things. But, you know, by the time he got to his Ninth Symphony, pulling from the American experience was so filled with melody and sophistication, yet it's uniquely American when you stop and listen to it. But it's also, I believe he was homesick when he wrote it. So there's so much in the music that reflects both.
Well, then let's talk about the music. Can you give us a description of the New World Symphony? I read something about the way that it was described, a synthesis of various melodies and rhythms. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Dvorak, when he got to America, was like a sponge. You know, it really was the New World. You know, and we have to really remember all the things we take for granted. Instant communication, television, video, you know, photographs that instantly appear over the internet. None of that happened. So it was all a big adventure. You know, just landing in New York City from Prague was such a different experience. But the music itself, he was obsessed in a good way with the sights that he saw, the sounds that he heard, and especially gospel music. He hired a black singer, a gospel music specialist, to come sing gospel songs for him because he loved them and he wanted to make them, you know, part of his musical vocabulary as far as just because he enjoyed them. There are even recordings of this artist that you can hear, whose name has just gone up out of my brain. But you can hear throughout the piece elements of black music, spirituals, especially the second movement, which has been sort of subtitled Going Home, because a hymn/spiritual emerged from that oboe English horn of the English horn theme. It should be noted that the oboe English horn theme by Dvorak came first and then morphed into a hymn/spiritual. But also there is there are moments of grandeur in the third movement that to me sound like an 1893 version of Ken Fuchs' vision of in 2007 of the Big West, of Wyoming, of the majesty of that grandeur. And also, Dvorak was captivated by Native American Indian music. And musicologists can go on and on and on about how da-da-dun-dun, da-da-dun, the repeated same pitch is evident in some Native American music. You could, but when I mention the homesick quality that exists as well, right off the top of the piece, there's a very quiet, we'll call it a prelude, in the strings, and that after, you know, six bars or so, are interrupted by a jab of a French horn. And I've always thought that that sounds to me like a ship's horn. It could be a ship horn going back home to Europe. It could be the ship's horn crossing Ellis Island, going by Ellis Island, which I'm not sure if it was there yet. I believe it was. You know, heralding a new thing into America, an entrance into America. But there is in the third movement, there are, it's a scherzo that sounds very familiar to the scherzo from the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven. I don't think that that's a coincidence. You know, da-da-da, da-da-da, and a timpani lick that sounds just like what used to be the Huntley-Brinkley Report music on NBC. But then in the middle of it, it's sort of da-da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da. It turns into what I would call sort of a peasant Slavic dance. So that's going on as well. So I think he was absorbing everything he was taking in, yet there was a longing for also going home, to quote the lyrics that eventually became part of the second movement melody. There's a quote that I think is pretty terrific of Dvorak that I would like to read, because a lot of people think that he took melodies and built the symphony around them. And he heard a melody, and what he heard, he adapted. No. Dvorak says, I should never have written the symphony like I have if I hadn't seen America. That's important. In response to people thinking he actually used black melodies or Native American music, he wrote, and these are his words, translated, I wrote my own themes, embodying in them the qualities of Indian music and using these themes as subjects. I developed them with all the resources of modern rhythm, harmonization, counterpoint, and orchestral coloring. So out of the horse's mouth, you know. So anybody who thinks it's derivative, no, inspired by is a better word. But he certainly didn't use any specific thing that he heard. But it's all a reaction to what he experienced.
Well, I'll tell you, this program sounds like it's going to be absolutely fantastic, intriguing, and all of those adjectives. And I encourage everyone to take part by experiencing Americana with guest conductor Kevin Stites, leading, of course, the Rockford Symphony Orchestra, on Saturday, April 29th. And where else would it be but the Coronado Performing Arts Center? If you would like to get more information about the concert, or, of course, buy tickets, go to rockfordsymphony.com, or you can call 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson. Thank you for listening.